Let's start with something just a little different. Here are the sisters, Bill and Beth Stephen, with their fifth record, The Green Album, launched into the world with a new single and the accompanying video of Climate Change.
Ooh, I've heard of climate change, people changing their ways. I've heard the whole world's involved. I'd like to lend a hand, I'd like to understand what I can do on my own. Just count my significance. You've underestimated. A garden I can watch grow. They'll help to clean up the air. I'll learn what grows well and where. We can eat some of the food. So what we buy is reduced, yeah.
Find a link to the teeny tiny Stevie's Climate Change official music video in the show notes. Yes, and welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to the opening segments of the podcast Everything We Need by Carla Brettel.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung. We pay our respects to elders past and present and express our gratitude for their care of this country and extend that respect to all First Nations people listening.
7.
What's this one say?
Climate change.
What's this last one here?
Drought.
Maybe one day climate change might change so much that maybe the world might turn into a square.
Well, I know one thing about the climate change. If there's a red sky in the morning, that would mean that there's rain coming.
I'm only 16, so there's a lot of things to go. And I mean, if we don't start changing things now, then things are going to get really sideways by the time I'm old enough and the next generation of kids come through.
Like, it might cause all the heat might like change the world and shapeshift it.
One of the challenges of adapting to the changing climate is simply imagining a world that's different from the one we know and expect to wake up to every day.
Because the climate change is turning so strong that if we don't stop it, the world might turn into something different.
I'm Kyla Brittle and this is Everything We Need, a climate podcast about making change in our lives for the better. With stories about people asking what can we do to adapt using the tools and materials we have now and rethinking what we all need to thrive now and into the future.
Most of our projections of climate change only extend out to 2100, but out towards that second half of the century where children born today will be living the prime part of their lives, we're looking at global temperature changes of between 1.5 to 3 degrees, potentially more. And so climate conditions start to move towards more of those sort of extreme events, such as the floods and the bushfire conditions of 2019. So the limits that we're used to dealing with, we start to go beyond those limits, and they are things that we haven't experienced before, and also that our infrastructure isn't set up to go beyond those limits. It's going to start impinging on people's lives more regularly.
Graham Green, Principal Advisor on Climate Change Science for the South Australian Government.
You'll find a link for that new episode of Everything We Need in the show notes. It's headed, Growing Leaders in Mirrabooka, How a School Groundsman and Students Tackle Climate Change. Regular listener Jonathan was kind enough to put me onto this podcast by Dr. Carl. It's called The Niffageddon with Dr. Trubisky. Here is the first part and you'll find a link for the entire episode in the show notes.
G'day, Dr. Carl, University of Sydney, Show Notes of Science, and here to talk about how plants and food production will change if we do nothing about climate change. And so I've been very lucky here to be talking with Dr. Piotr, P-I-O-T-R, so that's pronounced
Piotr,
and T-R-E-B-I-C-K-I, which I'm guessing is not pronounced Trebecki, but rather
Trembitsky.
And the paper is Climate Change and Plant Virus Epidemiology. So you're looking at food production and how it will change under climate change. There's insects, and some of these insects have got 4 generations already inside them when they're born, but also viruses. I kind of knew that insects attack plants, but viruses?
There's quite a few different viruses, and they can really do a fair bit of damage. Given right conditions, they can reduce their yield, they can reduce the quality of the plant, you know, grain products and such, but also they can kill the plant altogether. There are insects that obviously can transmit them in a similar way as malaria is being transmitted by mosquitoes.
How many viruses can attack plants? Like, is it 1 or 10 or 100?
Oh, there can be quite a few different ones, you know. I've been working with wheat, barley, also in canola and some other horticultural crops. And we do see a few different virus species within one plant. Most of the time could be like one main virus species, but there's quite a few different ones in Australia that can invade the plant and do the damage.
We humans, 8% of our DNA is viruses, and we have viruses living in us, and most of them are not harmful. So I'm guessing the same would be the case in plants?
Yeah, absolutely. So there could be quite a few different viruses that just hang there, but might not be doing much damage. I guess we don't really know much about those viruses because we still try to understand, you know, what's happening with viruses that actually do the damage. But definitely there are viruses that we can detect in a plant, but potentially that virus does not do any harm to the plant.
Now, in your paper, you talk about how viruses can use different strategies to travel around to get from plant to plant. And you mentioned, firstly, they can modify their host or vector so that they get transmitted more efficiently?
Yes, yeah. Most of the viruses are transmitted by insect vectors.
Most viruses are transmitted by insects, okay.
Absolutely. I mean, they can go to seeds as well.
That's a second one.
Yes, but also ones that are going to seeds can be transmitted by insect vector as well. So the main cause of epidemic, we think, is through insects. And aphids are the main ones that spread the viruses.
You also mentioned that the virus persists in the insect vector so they can survive in a few generations.
They can't go from insect to insect, many of them. But, you know, let's say aphid that does not have virus go and feed on virus-infected plant and take up the virus into their body. And then through all their life, as the aphid goes from plant to plant, can transmit that virus.
You mentioned something weird about aphids, which just blew my mind. Like, when a human female person is born, that person carries, say, 400,000 eggs, which have got half of the DNA needed to make another human, and the males have got to make the sperm. But you're saying with the aphids, when they come out, when they turn into an adult, they can carry within them an egg, and inside that egg there's another generation inside that?
Yes.
So you got the adult aphid, and then what's the first generation inside that?
So they have like nymphs already developing. So as aphid is going from different larval stages, within that aphid, they're already babies are being sort of, you know, developing as well. So when the aphid reaching adulthood, they actually can give birth to live nymphs.
They can do sexual reproduction.
Yes.
Or they can do non-sexual reproduction.
Now, please don't forget, you'll find the link for that podcast, Shirt Loads of Science with Dr. Carl, in the show notes. Now we have a story from the Melbourne Age by Erin Turner and Gerard Brody. It has the headline, Green Petrol and Ecoplastic. Fake Earth-friendly claims are out of control. Let's listen to that now, and you'll find a link for the story in the show notes.
Whether shopping in the supermarket or mall or browsing online, shades of green and blue are everywhere. Claims that products are green, eco, or sustainable are almost universal. After all, we all want to do our bit for the environment and future generations. But if a company tells you that their product is an earth-friendly choice, often with a price premium, how can you know if it's true? Last week, the ACCC initiated court action against the company that makes Glad bags for stating that some bags were made from 50% recycled ocean plastic. The term ocean plastic makes it sound like the plastic was sourced directly from the neck of a suffering sea turtle. In reality, the Glad bags were made from plastic found up to 50 kilometers away from the shoreline. Frequently, companies employ misleading eco claims to divert attention from the significant environmental impact of their product. Ampol, for instance, markets a carbon-neutral petrol that offsets emissions, but the company's primary product is carbon-intensive fossil fuel. Mecca Cosmetics advertises sustainable packaging on social media, but only postage materials are sustainable, not the product packaging. Panasonic makes vague claims of being for the planet, without specifying what that entails. Greenwashing is pervasive. Too often the promotion of environmental virtues is more about marketing than making a real impact. The true danger lies in its ability to sabotage our attempts to make sustainable purchases, tricking us into supporting practices that betray our ethical and environmental principles. While it is positive that the ACCC is suing Glad, we cannot just rely on legal action to stamp out false green claims. Rather than tell us the truth, marketing departments can subtly shift key messages to avoid the regulator's gaze. For example, following initial scrutiny, Glad removed the term ocean plastic and instead claimed that the bags were made using 50% ocean-bound plastic. It's perhaps much harder for a regulator to prove where plastics are bound to end up. Several years ago, the ACCC lost a similar case against Woolworths, which had labeled its picnic wear as biodegradable and compostable, with eco-friendly imagery. However, the court ruled that the claims were not misleading because, although the picnic wear could not be composted at home, it was suitable for industrial composting systems, a detail not specified on the packaging. The problem is that most vague and unhelpful claims aren't technically breaking the law. A claim that a product is eco or greener is so vague that it's hard to prove that it is misleading customers. Even worse is where a business uses its marketing to hide the truth. A mining company boasting on social media that uses clean tech conveniently omits information about the environmental harms of other parts of its business. This is a problem not just for customers, but for businesses trying to do the right thing. There are companies in Australia offering genuinely sustainable products and services, but it's far too difficult to tell the difference between the good options and those stretching the green truth. This is why we need to reform our consumer laws to require better and more useful marketing and information. Helpfully, we can learn from new laws internationally. The European Union is in the process of banning generic environmental claims like eco, green, or gentle on the environment. These claims are meaningless, and they need to go. Australia should also ban confusing and unhelpful claims. More crucial, perhaps, are laws that ban emissions or hiding important information. These laws could confront companies that advertise a genuinely sustainable product line while concealing their environmentally harmful practices elsewhere. Additionally, all environmental claims should be backed by strong, credible, and current evidence. This is especially crucial for future-oriented claims, such as companies advertising themselves as plastic-free or carbon-neutral by a certain date. Stopping bad green claims is only half the battle. We also need to help people evaluate products on key environmental factors, such as durability and repairability. For example, in France, products like laptops, phones and washing machines must display a score that shows shoppers how they stack up against others in terms of spare parts availability and the duration of software updates. Australians deserve this kind of basic information when shopping for big purchases. The federal government could invest, like France has, in a mandatory labelling system that shows how long products will last. This would allow you to compare the durability of items like washing machines, much like you currently compare their energy and water efficiency with star ratings. In Australia, it is not easy being green. There are too many confusing environmental claims, and the limited powers of our regulators make it harder to identify truly ethical companies. New laws that eliminate poor quality claims and help us find better products would be good for the environment but also good for budgets, helping us find options that last longer and are easier to repair. Erin Turner is Chief Executive of the Consumer Policy Research Centre. Gerard Brody is the Chair of the Consumers Federation of Australia.
Most of my working life has been as a print reporter, and so whenever I come across anything which is about newspapers or distribution of newspapers or public interest journalism, I cannot resist it. And so it was only a few days ago that I heard a program on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation entitled The Great Distribution Dilemma: Can Public Interest Journalism Survive? Now, I've included the whole episode here. Now, this may not interest many people, but what's important, I think, what's important is they talk about news aversion. And so understanding climate change is not about news aversion. It's about embracing the whole thing. It's about trying to do your best to understand what it's about. And so what concerns me about this, of course, is that my podcast, Climate Conversations, may well be inappropriately named. Because immediately people see climate, they turn off, or some people do, or many people do. And so it's a bit of a binary thing. Many people turn off straight away, some people don't. But anyway, let's have a listen to this Australian Broadcasting Corporation program, The Great Distribution Dilemma: Can Public Interest Journalism Survive?
Has the serious news business reached another turning point? That's the question for this episode of Future Tense. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. After more than a decade of being courted and then spurned by the big social media and tech companies, news organisations around the world are now left with a distribution dilemma of diabolical proportions. The central problem is this: how to maintain and grow their audiences in an increasingly online world when the likes of Facebook and X, formerly Twitter, have now declared they're no longer interested in distributing genuine professional news content. It's a critical issue for both commercial news outfits and public broadcasters. And if the distribution of public interest journalism is severely curtailed in future, what are the implications for society and democracy? A panel discussion today, and we're joined by science and technology reporter James Pertil, author, editor and academic Julianne Schultz. Julianne's a former board member of the ABC and chair of the Conversation Media Group. And finally, Andrew Davies, the manager of digital and audio content development for Radio National. Welcome all, and let's get into it. James, in 2023, the digital-only media outfit BuzzFeed folded, it went under, and its founding editor Ben Smith declared, and this is the quote, the end of the marriage between social media and news. Now, take us back to the very early days of that marriage, and just remind us, what attracted the news industry to social media in the first place?
Yeah, it was a marriage, and it was also a tragic romance. My journalism career started in 2010, and, you know, like any tragic romance, there's three phases. There's the initial phase of getting to know each other, and then there's a stage of infatuation, and then rejection. So 2010 was getting to know each other. You know, Facebook had really just started up. News organisations were still quite large and had lots of employees, and they were just sort of seeing who this upstart was. And Facebook went out of its way to try and attract that news content. And it meant that news organisations got a huge number of clicks. Like, you could write an article that would go viral potentially around the world, which was an entirely new thing. And you could potentially get an audience of millions of people to an article online. That was an amazing thing for news orgs. And we saw companies like BuzzFeed and Vice News kind of turn on this fire hose of traffic from social media and become quite big media organisations in a short space of time, entirely through getting clicks and getting the ad revenue associated with that.
I used the word courted in the introduction. It really was courting, wasn't it? Because Facebook in particular was going out there and it was talking to digital content makers and saying, look, here's the kind of deal we can do for you to improve your news coverage, your distribution.
That's right. They brought in new tools that made it easier for publishers to publish the articles and to track the clicks they were getting. You know, they mounted a charm offensive. They really wanted that content to bulk out their platform. And it really worked. I mean, Facebook had more and more users. The engagement was very high. And it was kind of this wonderful, in a way, relationship that just powered ahead. And then kind of, it just went too fast. And around about 2016, the wheels came off.
Now, Facebook's parent company, Meta, it now says that news makes up only 3% of what people see on their feeds. If that's true, doesn't that indicate that Meta's move away from news content actually makes commercial sense for them?
Yes, that's right. So now Meta doesn't really have much news on the platform. And that's been a change that sort of began around 2016. And the amount of news on the platform as the share of total content has gone down. I think it was about 5% a few years ago, now it's 3%. And it's true, they don't want news content. And one of the main reasons for that is they don't want the responsibilities that come with hosting news content. That includes weeding out misinformation. And that was a lesson they learned around 2016.
Julianne Schultz, we keep hearing that many people these days use social media as their main source of news. But that can be misleading, can't it? Because what Facebook and others define as news is not necessarily what we would think of as journalists as news, is it?
What we define as news, I guess, is what's grown out of traditional news organisations. And, of course, the business models that Facebook and the others work on is actually not about engaging with the content in a serious fashion. What they're interested in is the attention that can be gained, the fleeting moment of attention that can generate income. So there's a real sort of mismatch between what we traditionally understand as news and the business model that drives those platforms. And what they've done in the process is obviously to have soaked up the advertising that used once to be in the commercial media. And with that, the production of news content has disappeared or has been under challenge in traditional media organisations.
And in those traditional media organisations, what even they define as news has started to change over time, hasn't it, as they've chased social media platforms and distribution?
Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, what they're interested in is attention. And so the best way of generating attention is not necessarily about solid information. It's about things that attract your attention and hold it fleetingly. So, yes, they move from that. I mean, I think it's obviously true that the data shows that Facebook news is no longer significant as a sort of driver of traffic, which it once was for all of those platforms. But it's always that mystery with, especially with Facebook, you know, what's happening to the algorithm? What are they changing that makes things just disappear? So it's not that I'm no longer interested in news, I just can't find it. And so you do feel a little powerless in that sort of relationship because the algorithm that's shaping your feed is actually beyond your control.
Andrew Davies, the relationship between news organisations and these big platforms, it's been imperfect, as we've just heard, right from the beginning. particularly around brand recognition and attribution, hasn't it?
Yes, you're right, it has. And I think there's a real challenge for not just public media, but media organisations in general, because to Julianne's point and what James was just saying, when people share content, there's almost one step removed from when that content is shared. So in other words, people will share content with their friends. So there's a sense that do media organisations get the full credit in terms of attribution once someone shares it with 10 of their friends, they share it with 10 more and 10 more and 10 more.
Well, there's research, isn't there, that shows that people can read an article, say, online. They can really like that article. But if you ask them afterwards, which media company produced that article, they start scratching their heads.
That's right. And I think it's true also for other forms of media, particularly audio. That's why you'll see, particularly in the podcast space, for example, organisations putting oral branding at the front of their audio to people actually know that that content came from the ABC or the BBC or the CBC, that kind of thing. So it's a challenge in terms of, particularly for public media, where one of our, you know, our key measures is really kind of that engagement with the public. And if the public are not sure, not certain that the content has come from, say, the ABC or the BBC, then how are we really measuring that value in the community and particularly, you know, in broader society?
Platform algorithms are an issue, as Julianne mentioned just before, but also the kind of associations that can be drawn online. You know, if, say, an organisation like the ABC posts a serious news story, it's got no control over what's seen around it, you know, what advertising or what other stories are also in a person's feed.
No, that's right. And I think, as Julianne was just saying, I think particularly so with Meta or Facebook, there's that sense of it capturing attention, but also monetizing off that content. So what's the position for, say, a public media organization or a commercial media organization if their content is being monetized, but they're not getting the value from that in a commercial sense? And it's about it capturing attention, which then flows through clearly to monetization as well.
Now, you've just returned from the annual Radio Days conference in Europe. And this dilemma over distribution, it was very much at the heart of the discussions there, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So Radio Days Europe is a big whole of audio conference devoted to podcasting, radio, smart speakers. AI was a dominant theme this year. And I think it's a challenge, particularly for in the podcast space, where one of the things that, or one of the reasons podcasting grew in the first place was this sort of decentralized approach. People created what they call RSS feeds, and they were able to publish that, and then the content was available across different platforms. But one of the things that's come up, particularly in Europe, and particularly in some of the Nordic regions, is the concern around to what extent platforms like Spotify are eroding their reach when it comes to their domestic markets. So there's a concern there from particularly countries with particular languages, so in Denmark or Sweden or Norway or wherever it might be. And we're seeing platforms or companies like NRK, which is a Norwegian public broadcaster, take a more, I guess, proactive approach to pulling their audio content off third-party platforms and trying to prioritise their own platform as the way that people engage with their content. So I don't think anybody has cracked this dilemma in terms of this distribution strategy, but we're seeing people, particularly public media, trying to have more ownership of the way people engage with their content, be it their news app, be it their audio app, be it their newsletters, that direct engagement with their audience, which particularly is important for public media, commercial media in general, to have that more direct control, maybe not control, but the influence with their audience and not necessarily be subject to the whims of an algorithm from a third-party platform.
And for a small public broadcaster, say Norway, there's a big risk there in pulling away from the third-party platforms, isn't there?
There is. And it's a balance between, you know, I think the remit of a lot of public media particularly is to be where the audience are, the broader charter. So it's that balance between, will people come back to your platform to engage with the audio content? Will you lose your reach as a result of that? Do you need to be on the platform to engage with the audience? It's an interesting dilemma.
Julianne, your thoughts?
Yeah, it is particularly interesting for countries where languages other than English are dominant. And in a way, they have an advantage that we don't. I mean, if you're an English-speaking country, you're in the wash with every other bit of English-speaking content from around the world. If you're Norwegian or German or Thai or even French, you know, you've actually got a more corralled sort of audience in a way, which is gives you an advantage because a national public broadcaster has a national responsibility, which is different to what a, you know, just a general sort of monetizing process that happens in commercial media. In a way, I sort of feel envious of people who are in those countries that have a very distinctive national language because it does give them that point of distinction and an opportunity to, with their audience, explore issues which are particular to that place. We lose that in a way because we're in a wash of English language.
That's right, although particularly in Europe where there's a high degree of English spoken, I think there's a concern, particularly in the Nordic regions, around the fact that a lot of the population do speak English. Mm. So there is a fear of the influence of US podcasting or UK podcasting or, dare I say, Australian podcasting in that particular region. Mm. So I think that's interesting as well. Mm.
Julianne, in recent years, various Western governments have enacted laws to force the big tech players or to try to force the big tech players to fund local news content. And in Australia, that's through what's called the News Media Bargaining Code. But it's fair to say, isn't it, that, you know, in terms of addressing the underlying problem for journalism, those kind of arrangements, that kind of legislation really hasn't done a lot, has it?
Well, it produced, through the sort of voluntary process, quite a decent amount of money for the major news organisations in Australia over the couple of years that it was running here. Now, Facebook Meta have said that they're disinclined to continue their relationship with the Australian media organisations. And so there's a risk of, with the Facebook process, of I think it's $74 million or thereabouts each year not going into the Australian media. Look, I think it was a valiant attempt to try and address a problem, which was that the traditional media organisations were losing their purchase. You know, they'd become less profitable, jobs were being lost in significant numbers, and places were becoming deprived of news information. I was always a little bit critical of the code because it didn't actually require the media companies to put the money into journalism. I mean, in the best places, the best use of that money.
It could have just gone to the news organisation's bottom line.
Absolutely. And I think in many cases that's what happened. And what Facebook did in their first round of negotiations was effectively to require the news organisations to come up with some other new thing that they weren't doing. They didn't want to be being charged for their platform, essentially. And so there were some really good initiatives. I mean, the ABC Regional Journalism Project, for instance, was a really good initiative that came with that money.
Where that money was used to fund specific new positions in country Australia.
That's right. And that was a really good example of how that could be used. But there were some of the others were sort of make-work exercises that essentially got the money back into the media organisations. And I think in a way it sort of misses the point. I mean, if you're wanting to increase media diversity, the range of information that citizens have access to, the quality of that media that's available, there's a public policy question, which is, do we need a more diverse and more robust journalism ecology, if you like, in a country like Australia? Yes, I think undoubtedly we do. Maybe some of the money for that comes from the platforms, but maybe there's some other mechanisms that we need to be thinking about that go to what the real problem is, that is the diversity of public interest journalism.
And we're still seeing politicians, governments talking about trying to force these big tech players to come on board and fund in the way that, you know, the requests have been in the past. But we see Google has reportedly started to remove California news websites from their search results because of proposed legislation in that state in the US. Meta, Facebook's parent company, has instituted a ban on news in Canada, which is still going more than 6 months later. Mm. Are both of those examples evidence that the big tech companies aren't going to be moved on this? They don't fear government anymore, even if they once did.
Well, I don't know that they ever did. I think they should probably start to fear them a little bit more than they have in the past, because I think governments are now waking up to what the risks are of these global corporations controlling the information flow for the world, with a legislative framework in the US that basically says they can put anything up they like and have no responsibility for it. I think that governments around the world are really now starting to grapple with what that means for their domestic polity and the sort of commercial space that they operate in as well. I mean, if those companies are absorbing, I think in Australian case, 80% of the advertising, which used to go to a whole lot of other platforms, that represents a real issue in terms of the robustness of the sort of local microeconomy as well. So, yes, I think that pushback that you're starting to see in the US especially, I mean, because there's legislation, both national and Californian legislation, which is under consideration, which would have quite serious implications. And the money that would go under the model of the Californian legislation, which is, of course, the home to most of the big tech companies, so they feel it very personally or very directly. The way that that legislation is structured, it's designed to reward media companies for clicks. So what does that say a media company is going to do? They're going to put up the stuff which is, you know, the two-headed baby with, you know, the nonsense stuff that creates the clicks, rather than the substantive public interest journalism. And it only applies to companies which make above a certain threshold of income. And it doesn't apply to the sort of new ways that people are now trying to create new sorts of media products, you know, whether it's with WhatsApps or it's audio or, you know, all sorts of other things. And most of the companies, the traditional media in California, are hedge funds. You know, so you can just see this process where the money goes back into the bottom line of these major companies. They don't actually put it into the journalism because they're about running a sort of a business as effectively as they can. So there's a bit of a pushback that's coming the other way, I think, in the US as well, which is saying, if what we want to fund is public interest and good local journalism, let's look at the mechanisms that are going to do that rather than taking a slice off these very enormously wealthy companies and putting it back into some other middling-sized companies.
Just to rewind a bit, I just want to sort of ground it in something that people might really care about, because sometimes when we talk about public interest journalism, it's quite an abstract thing. But in the last decade, something like 5,000 jobs in journalism have been lost in Australia. That's more than there are jobs in journalism right now. And of those jobs, a lot of them have been pushed towards those two-headed baby type stories that Julianne described. So Australian media has just been hollowed out, and the stories that we need to be telling, they're not being told. Some of them are being told, but a lot of them aren't. And that has implications for corruption, for participation in democracy, and so on. Journalism is a public good, and we should fund it in the way that we fund other public goods. I don't mean putting all the money to the ABC, but recognising that government needs to play a role in funding this thing that benefits all of us. And that means separating it from the clicks, because that old model where you chase the clicks and you got advertising revenue, that doesn't work anymore. That's why BuzzFeed folded, Vice folded. You know, in the US, they're talking about an extinction level event this year in US media.
I know that you've spoken to various academics who've talked about the idea of the government actually reframing, if you like, public interest journalism as vital infrastructure, as vital public infrastructure. How would that actually work?
Well, that's up for debate. But yeah, framing it as, you know, roads or power lines, I could imagine a system where you have grants that can go to commercial media orgs, but the grants are tied to specific journalism output. It's not that money isn't just being funneled into propping up a legacy media company. You know, you have to produce something. And we see outlets like The Guardian doing that with philanthropic donations. They produce a certain amount of work from that. So I could see that working. You know, strong public broadcaster like the ABC is vital. Australian media would be in much, much worse state without the ABC right now.
Julianne?
And that might sound self-serving, but it's true.
Yeah, absolutely, it's true. And, you know, making the ABC and SBS more robust is really an important part of it. And it was interesting that in that news media bargaining code, for instance, that Facebook just refused to settle with SBS. You know, it's an important source of news in Australia. They do original, different work to what the ABC does, and they couldn't get over the line in terms of Facebook support. Similarly, The Conversation, which I was chairing at the time, couldn't get that level of support. So, yes, I think it's a matter of thinking a bit more innovatively about what it is, and I think, as James says, you know, of actually elevating journalism as a public interest good. I mean, one of the things that I quite like, and it's been trialled in a couple of places, is to provide tax incentives for hiring journalists. So if you employ a journalist, for instance, in a news organisation, you know, you get a tax benefit as the employer for doing that. So that puts the onus on actually the employment of journalists rather than on getting the money that gets you the return. Because you've seen, for instance, in News Corp, I mean, there have been huge numbers of redundancies over this period, but they've got a lot of money out of the bargaining codes. If the mechanism was such that it pulled it back and said, the value of this is in the journalism, that's what we're going to fund, and we're going to ensure that that journalism operates at the most professional level, that's quite different to the models that we've currently got.
In Australia, there is public funding for the ABC and also for the SBS, the Special Broadcasting Service. Mm. Do you see a possibility in the future for government individually funding private commercial operators for certain types of journalism, as long as that journalism can be assessed as being independent?
Mm. Well, two things. One is, I think Australia has evolved a very good mechanism, not perfect, but a good mechanism for establishing a separation between what the government wants and what the public broadcaster does. It's not a state broadcaster in that sense, or they're neither of them state broadcasters. In terms of funding directly, I mean, there have been a bunch of different trials that the government has implemented over time for local news, you know, a whole lot of different things that have been attempted. I'm not sure that somebody's yet come up with the perfect model that makes that work. But there are lots of examples around. And I think that one of the things that we learned from the first round of the News Media Bargaining Code was there are a lot of media innovations that are happening now as well. I mean, there's lots of quite interesting things happening in communities where language other than English is spoken, where there are special interest groups, you know, where there are cohorts of things. And I think that the danger is that if you get a trade-off between the big tech companies and the big media companies, you get more of the same. And what's the data showing us? The data is showing us that people are turning off the news, that news aversion is at an all-time high.
Andrew Dace?
Yes, I just wanted to comment on that, because I think one of the points that James and Julian have been talking about is the importance of public interest journalism, which I wouldn't disagree with at all. But I think other thing that's worth pointing out is the reason we're talking about the importance of Meta or X or Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever the platform is because of the proliferation of choice available to consumers now and the fact that it's so hard to find audiences increasingly in a world of infinite choice for media organisations. Arguably, 50% of what you do is creating the content and 50% is finding the audience. And that's increasingly hard, which is why media organisations are in this tricky dilemma of trying to find the distribution partners of platforms that will help them reach the audiences they need, either for a commercial model or for an audience reach model, say in the case of public media. And that's not going away. It's arguably getting harder.
Because if you're a broadcaster, say, like the ABC, you can develop, as we have, very good apps but they're always going to be limited in a way to the kind of content that is produced here in Australia. They're not going to have that broad global appeal, are they? That or to try and do that, it's going to be very expensive.
It is, and it's important, as I said before, I think important for media organisations to have that influence or direct influence with their audience and their consumers in terms of the way they engage, so they're not subject to the whims of algorithmic change from a Meta or a Spotify or wherever it might be. But it is that challenge of, if you like the ABC content, you're going to come to the ABC Listen app, but if you're a broader podcast consumer, you're probably going to want to consume podcasts from other platforms or other publishers. So how do you, as a media organisation, take ABC as an example, or BBC Sounds, how do you try and meet the needs of that audience who might want other content? Do you license other content in, as it might be, or do you focus exclusively on your selling points of your content for your own platform and your own publisher? So it's a tricky balance.
From your experience with other public broadcasters, how successful are they at developing their own apps? Because it does take a lot of money. And again, if you're talking about small organisations, or even moderately large organisations, the big tech companies have lots of money, the venture capital, to develop the technology. It's a very difficult thing to try and compete with them on that level, isn't it?
It is. And I think one of the points that's been made at the conference I was at, CEO of Swedish Radio made the point that media companies are no longer just media companies, they're media and technology companies. And I think that's a shift in not just for public media, but, you know, commercial media in general. And it's how much can you devote towards building your own platforms, building your own products, relative to, you know, to going where the audience are. And I think it's that balance. And I think public media budgets broadly probably are not increasingly massively around the world globally. So it's kind of that balance of how much does an organisation choose to spend on an infrastructure project or a platform to try and engage with an audience, as opposed to also trying to be where the audience are. And that's in some ways that's platform politics, and that's kind of nuanced. And it's how do you engage with the other platforms, because they want to keep people on their platform, but you're trying to draw people to your platform. So how do you secure promotion on other platforms at the same time as trying to draw people to your own platform?
And just to add into that complexity, you know, the amount of money that's being spent by the tech companies on developing AI is going to completely, I don't think there's any media organisation in the world which has got the depths of pockets to actually be developing AI in the way that the tech companies are doing. They're milking the media companies to refine their models, and you see the big test case at the moment in the United States between the New York Times and the AI companies, but that is going to manifestly change what we regard as the media information that we get. And public interest journalism is a small micro dot subset of that. That's why I come back to saying, well, actually, the state, because it has a state, the state has an interest in the information resources that are available to its citizens, has a different sort of responsibility than playing in this space, which is a crossover commercial tech media game, which is about its own ends, you know, good at times, excellent at times, terrible at other times. But the interest that the state has in terms of an informed citizenry is actually sitting off to one side. And it's been convenient in a way that for so many decades it's been able to find an accommodation, and that advertising was the lever that made that possible. That's broken. And so what's needed now is something that's different. And in an Australian context, that's really interesting. I mean, this country was known as the land of newspapers at the turn of the 20th century. You know, there were so many newspapers because distance was great, information was not available. Every new town that settled needed its own newspaper because, you know, you couldn't rely on something, you know, that was happening a long way away. But at the same time, it was interesting that even at sort of the point of federation, when the constitution is being drafted, and all around the world at that time where constitutions were being drafted, freedom of speech, freedom of the press were built into the constitutions. It didn't happen here. And so the sort of the notion that there was a land of newspapers, but it was a sort of grace and favour sort of thing. It wasn't something that was actually built into the body of the
nation. So we never explicitly stated our value for news.
That's right. And so now we find ourselves in a position where you can get everything you want at a push of a button from around the world. But what is it that we as Australian citizens actually need at this time that actually enables us to conduct our lives better and more fully when you've got 29 local government areas in Australia have zero local news?
James Patel, bringing you back into the conversation here, because we shouldn't forget as well that by the beginning of this century, the Australian media was one of the most concentrated on earth.
Yeah, exactly. We shouldn't be romantic or romanticise the media that we had, say, before Facebook in the noughties had huge problems, and we shouldn't be trying to recreate that.
And speaking of that journalism product, I know you have reservations about the way in which journalism has changed because of social media, the influence that chasing social media has had on the nature of journalism.
When I joined the ABC, it was around 2013, and I joined as a digital producer And I came on as kind of this new tranche of employees who were going to bring the ABC content online. And there was tension there within the newsroom because we came in and we were saying, these sorts of stories are doing well online. And, you know, there were reporters there who were saying, well, that isn't the important story. We should be, you know, pushing this local politics story. But we had the authority of saying, well, this is actually doing well. We have the figures here. And that fundamentally altered the politics of the newsroom because, you know, we had junior digital producers able to say, well, this is the stories that people want. And ultimately, what happened across the news industry is that there was a change in priorities around what sort of stories we covered. And, you know, sometimes it's a good thing because it puts you in touch with what people actually want to read. And sometimes it warps what should be covered.
Julianne, your thoughts?
Look, I've been involved over the last few years on an international jury for judging journalism, or the only global award for journalism. And there are four categories, and they deal with corruption, climate change, social change, and so on, from around the world. And every year I sit down and I read these applications, the journalism that's being produced in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, in India, in Pakistan, you know, as well as in the West. And what I am reminded of every time is just how energetic and how creative and how urgent this work is, the work of journalism that can't be done by, you know, we've got pretty well-developed sort of regulatory oversight mechanisms in a country like Australia. It's not done in many, many other countries. It's really left to journalism to do that. And what those international awards show is how urgent that work is, how it requires a very different sort of sensibility. That is, a journalist who's making inquiries about, you know, really serious stuff that's happening, but then also using the technology in all sorts of creative ways to build databases, to build networks, to build information sources that can be made readily available. We are in such a sort of sanitised world in Australia that, you know, sure, we can sort of cruise along with the stuff that we get, the Canberra dominance of the news, you know, and all the rest of it. I think sometimes we lose sight of just how important, as a really serious public good, journalism can be in developing that sense of what it means to be a citizen of whatever country you happen to live in.
Yes, if we are to have any chance of combating the climate crisis, we need our storytellers. So if you can support your local newspaper, do that. Please help the storytellers to keep the stories alive. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for coming. It's great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, how about you share this with your friends? Put it on networks. Let people know what's going on with the climate crisis. So please share this. Now, please, don't forget to check out the show notes, as my screen is alive with stories about the climate crisis. And I'll put as many links as I can in the show notes. So check them out, please. Also, I'd love to know what you think about this podcast, so contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so you can contact me at the same email address, and I can contact you via phone or via Zoom, and we can chat about the climate crisis. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.